I'd like to talk to you about the Dead Sea Scrolls. This message will inform you of the basics, everything you need to know to be able to discuss them intelligently with those who are interested, or perhaps even with skeptics. In 1997, this was my second time ever in Israel. I remember the afternoon that my wife came back to me, very excited. She said she had met someone from the Kondo family. Well, at that time, I knew some of the facts about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but not very much. But I did recognize the name Kondo. When the Bedouins discovered these scrolls, they brought them to Kondo. Iskander Kondo, we'll speak about him in a moment. And through his work as a middleman, you could say, the scrolls came to the attention of the broader academic community. And there was an invitation to tea. And I thanked Vicky and I said, that's great news. Yes. And within a day, I was with the Kondos in their store, sipping tea and talking about this most incredible archaeological find. I'll return to the story in just a moment, but I'm wondering, how much do you know about the Dead Sea Scrolls? If you're like most people, you've definitely heard of them, but most people simply leave it there. They don't go further. They don't see the scrolls or try to examine them or visit the caves where they were found or talk with scholars. I'm so happy that my wife ran into the Kondo family because that really accelerated my interest in these scrolls. In fact, when I visited them, I had just returned from climbing into one of the Dead Sea caves, cave number 6. And when I was in the Kondo store, there was a scroll jar, a jar that's quite tall, earthen jar. I remember asking them, where is that from? They said, cave 6. I said, I was just there. I was wearing shorts and I had cut my legs on the rock so they could see I'd been bleeding a little bit. I said, how did you bring that scroll jar back to the store in Bethlehem? And they said, oh, we just threw it on the back of the truck. And they said, would you like to hold it? I said, yes and no. Of course I'd like to hold it, but you shouldn't be letting me hold this. But they let me hold it. And when I came back, very soon after, they had built a protective case so that some bumbling tourist or foreigner doesn't mess this all up. Well, you know, years after I graduated with my master's degree from Harvard, I realized that my second year Hebrew professor was actually a prominent leader in the Dead Sea Scrolls project. His name is Frank Cross, F.M. Cross. I graduated in 1982, and I think this happens a lot when you're at university. You have these professors who actually have a life that you may not care about that much, who've written books that you hope you won't have to read. And especially when you're young, you don't really pay attention. I was 21 years old. Any rate, years later, I realized, I read it somewhere, that Cross, he was the founder of Qumran Studies. Now, Qumran is the name of the ancient settlement where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. So when I was his student, just a Hebrew student, I had other concerns. I wasn't particularly passionate about history, even though I had a bachelor's in history. I didn't really care so much about learning from the past, not as I do now. You know, I remember another time I was flying into Israel and I was striking up a conversation with the man next to me. He was in the window seat and I asked him his name and he said, Tov. I said, that's your whole name? Now, say again, I didn't recognize him. I should have. Because he's one of the leading scholars in Dead Sea Scroll research. And I asked him how would I see you when I get to Israel? He said, oh, you can ask anybody. And at the time, I thought that was a little bit arrogant. On the other hand, Israel is a small country. And yes, he is that well known. So I learned to my chagrin that he was a bigwig. And here I am displaying my ignorance yet again. Well, honestly, I'm still in the learning mode. But at least today, I recognize many of the principal persons involved in this ginormous project. And these are scholars who've toiled for decades to piece together the fragments and to undertake the arduous work of translation. Before we get too deep into this talk, let me emphasize again I'm no expert. I'm not an archaeologist. I simply have interest. I'm not an expert on the scrolls, though I've seen the Dead Sea Scrolls many times in Israel and around the world where they've gone on tour, as they often visit the world's premier museums. So you're listening to an amateur. But I've been to Israel more than 20 times, especially leading groups who are always interested in learning the basics about the scrolls. And gradually, I've become increasingly convicted of the need to be informed about the facts and the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, with that in mind, a few years ago, when I was setting some academic goals, I thought, well, one of these should be involving the scrolls. I had three or four things I wanted to complete, well, let's say before I lose my mind or lose my life. And I'm in the end part of my life now, so I understand that. One of the goals was to read all the non-biblical Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, when I say non-biblical, I don't want to be confusing. I'm pretty good at confusing people if I want to, if I'm careless, if I don't explain enough. Okay, non-biblical simply means the scrolls that are not copies of the books in the Bible. Right? So there are many of the scrolls, but it's less than half, that are copies of books in the Old Testament, but the majority are not. And that's where I was focusing. I wanted to read the other 60%. Well, I recently completed that project. It took me 3 years of reading on and off. And many of the facts that I'm going to share in this presentation were new to me. Some of them were surprising. I had a general knowledge, but I think I'm better informed now through these years of study. Now, if you want to read the translations of the scrolls that I read, there's a two-volume publication. It's about 1,300 pages, and there's an image that's clickable inside the notes. If you want to get that, you can follow in the same tracks that I and probably many others do. But as we see, the scrolls shed considerable light on Judaism, particularly in that period of, say, 200 BC up until maybe the middle of the first century AD. And that means that these documents illuminate the background of early Christianity. The discovery. The find of the Dead Sea Scrolls, at least the first ones, is credited to Muhammad ad-Dib. He was a Bedouin. Well, he's still alive as I speak. But when he was a teenager, he accidentally came across the first scrolls in the Qumran caves. Again, Qumran is the name of a settlement close to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea, as you may know, is the deepest depression on the earth, that is, on the surface of the earth. When you swim in the Dead Sea, which is quite an experience, you are more than 400 meters below sea level. That's not by sinking, that's by floating, which is really all you can do. Amazing. Well, the story is something like this. He and his friend were out, you know, they were herding goats, and they threw a rock into a cave, and they heard something shatter, and it was a scroll jar, and they went in there, and they found what looked like old leather with writing they didn't understand. And first, they thought, oh, good, we can repair our shoes. You know, this is leather. But somehow, they ended up getting it to Kondo, and Kondo realized, no, this is language. There is an opportunity here to do more than just mend shoes. By the way, Kondo had died by the time I met his sons. He has a number of sons, and we've had a chance to spend time together very often when I'm in Bethlehem. At any rate, Muhammad the Wolf is the one who made that initial discovery, and that's around 1947. And in the following few years, more and more scrolls are located, altogether in 11 caves. Now, you might think that that's the end of the story. Well, it's not, because just finding these things is not the whole project. They have to be translated, and sometimes they have to be put back together because they're broken up. And in fact, there are many caves in the Dead Sea area, not just the 11 caves, the 11 official caves, where scrolls were hidden by a single community in Qumran. Just a year or two ago, I was having dinner with a number of interested scholars and archaeologists, And I spoke to one of them. I'd heard lecture, I'd read one of his books, and I was just simply going up to thank him. We ended up talking for a while because he's spending a lot of time in the Dead Sea Caves as they continue to excavate and find different things. So this is a very dynamic archaeological area. The scrolls had been hidden since 68 AD. Now, if you know your basic first century history, the background, I guess, necessary background for understanding the New Testament, you know that the Romans were occupying Israel. They had been since the first century BC. And you also know, of course, about the war and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple that Jesus spoke of, for example, in Matthew 24. Well, as the Romans were closing in, the Essenes, we'll learn about them in a moment, the people who lived at Qumran, abandoned their settlement, but first hid the scrolls in fairly out-of-the-way locations, in caves. That war with Rome ends in 70 AD officially, and so the scrolls were hidden in the year 68 in 11 caves. 3, conspiracy. Often when I hear people talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, or if I bring up the topic, people become a bit cynical or sarcastic. They talk about the conspiracy. Yes, the Dead Sea Scrolls. I know religions is corrupt. They've been hiding the truth from us. You know, they prove the Bible's not right, or they show us Jesus is just a man, or, you know, there are all kinds of claims made. But these scrolls date before the time of Jesus. Don't be afraid that there's some embarrassing revelation concealed in the scrolls, or that ungodly academics are pulling a fast one on us. Some people think that something fishy is going on. Well, of course, in any project that lasts decades and involves scores of people, there will be misunderstandings, there'll be different motives, but we can safely ignore those. The conspiracy theories are without merit. Now, it's true that there were delays in translation, and that's because the scrolls were not all neatly, let's say, preserved in jars as we might imagine. Many of the jars were broken. Most of the scrolls are in fragments, sometimes in hundreds of fragments, and they're in caves, and so many of them were covered with bat excrement, with guano. And it took some fairly advanced techniques to even make out the writing on a number of these scrolls. I remember attending a conference once in Washington, and someone from Kodak, as in the photography industry, Kodak had been teaming up with scholars because advanced techniques were able to reveal what was not visible to the naked eye. This was not an easy thing. Oh, another reason there were delays, if you want to call it that, in translation, is that the scholars, but by the time people are, let us say, really competent in what they're doing, they're older. They're older men. They're the most experienced. And it's not surprising that they didn't all live to see the fruit of their work, that is, the publication. There were many cooks in the kitchen. Yes, sometimes bumping into each other, and there were sometimes political issues, but overall, there's nothing to worry about. Let me give an illustration that may help you. Our family, although we're all adults now, the kids are not really kids, shouldn't say that, but we like puzzles, all kinds of puzzles. And if it's a jigsaw puzzle, typically 1,000 pieces or more. Now, when you put together a jigsaw puzzle, normally, there's a picture on the box cover, and that's the guide. You keep looking up at that, and you have a sense of proportion and where pieces should go relative to other pieces. I think translating the scrolls is something like this. Of course, it was not a single scroll broken into 1,000 pieces. It was many scrolls broken into tens of thousands of pieces. So not all Dead Sea Scroll remnants are fragmentary, but many are. Something like 100,000 papyri and parchments, ranging from minuscule scraps to lengthy scrolls, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. So just imagine a 100,000-piece puzzle, not 1,000, but something 100 times as large. And next, they're not all from the same picture. Many pieces are in poor condition or missing entirely. There are no pictures. This is just writing. And it's not just in one language, but multiple languages. How quickly do you think you would complete such a gargantuan project? Do you think this is something that any one person could do? I don't think we would do so well. And so the scholars deserve our respect, not our suspicion, not criticism. Now, of course, the fascinating story is far more complicated than I'm going to be sharing in this talk. So pardon me for oversimplifying, but I'd rather you be intrigued than scared off by the complexity. So was there a cover-up? Was the Vatican involved? Did Christians try to suppress the amazing discovery? No way. The Dead Sea Scrolls were translated and published in English by the early 1990s, every single scrap, even those that are unidentifiable. So there's no conspiracy. These documents are available to you, to me, to anyone who has interest. 4. The Dead Sea Community. The Qumran community, which is at the northwest side of the Dead Sea, was established in the 1st century BC. It's a monastic settlement, just men. And that includes living quarters, a dining hall, immersion pools called mikvaot, where people immerse themselves daily for ritual cleansing, and a scriptorium, which is a place where manuscripts were copied, and some other buildings as well. If you visit Qumran, you walk on a boardwalk past or over the ruins of the Qumran community. It's widely agreed among scholars that these ruins are the material remains of a Jewish group called the Essenes. Disgusted with Jerusalem temple bureaucracy, they removed themselves to the desert in order to build a purified people of God and to prepare for an end times battle. 5. Rejecting the system. The Qumran community claimed that the Jerusalem high priest was corrupt. In fact, that the whole system was beyond remedy. In contrast, their own teacher of righteousness, that's a technical term, and that's probably the leader of the community, he was holy. The teacher of righteousness could be trusted. He didn't mislead God's people, unlike the Jerusalem priests. Think of Annas and Caiaphas, the two high priests who engineered the crucifixion of Christ. One was father-in-law, one was son-in-law. But we read about them in the New Testament. Jerusalem priests were often greedy, wealthy, arrogant, considered themselves above the law. And all this is pointed out in these non-biblical Dead Sea Scrolls. And I'm not going to be reading you the references, but if I did, I could say 1 QP Hab 8 to 9. You'd say, what are you talking about? 1 Q, Q for Qumran, P for Pesher, Hab for Habakkuk. There's a whole system of understanding this code, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I won't be giving you the references. They're in the notes that accompany this class. So the point is, these unscrupulous men were not godly shepherds. They were like the wicked shepherds of Ezekiel 34. They were fleecing the poor and widows. So instead of feeding the flock, they're fleecing the flock. And Jesus, of course, spoke out vehemently against such ungodly religious leaders in his day. For example, in Mark 12. Now, in the spirit of Malachi 1, the Qumran community rejected the temple and its sacrifices. Malachi is a place where the Lord says, oh, that one of you would close the doors, shut the doors to the temple, because the sacrifices are not acceptable. That is, the heart must be in the right place. And it was better to have no temple than a corrupt temple, since God would never honor meaningless sacrifices. With that in mind, the Essenes, or at least most of them, it seems, withdrew to the desert, to this community in Qumran. But there's some evidence that there were Essenes in other parts of Israel, perhaps even close to the city itself. Hierarchy and discipline. The Essene community was strictly hierarchical. There was an elaborate system for moving up in rank, besides a one-year probationary period before you were permitted to join. And not just anyone could join. Those excluded included those who were deranged, stupid people, feeble-minded, insane people, those who were lame or those who didn't walk well, deaf persons, underage boys. None of these were welcome. Also excluded were those with weak eyes, presumably because to copy manuscripts accurately, you had to have pretty good vision. They had all these rules. There were periods of discipline for various infractions, for example, falling asleep in one of their meetings, or speaking out of turn. That is, you're at a lower level in the hierarchy and you kind of jump the gun and you speak before those above you have had an opportunity to. And these periods of discipline that were imposed could last for days, weeks, months, or even years. I also learned that anyone over 60 was no longer permitted to serve as a judge for this community. And I thought, whoa, I'm over 60. But then I realized that these people weren't expelled, but they were required to yield their place to younger members, who, of course, could still benefit from the older members' wisdom. Okay, that's not so bad. Well, how about you and me? You know, as we think of the Essenes rejecting the system, that was number five in my presentation, six about the hierarchy and discipline. Are you fed up with the system? Do you long for purity and a good kind of structure in your life, as the Essenes did? Or maybe you're someone who defends the establishment. Think of the Sadducees or the Herodians. Or maybe you're a radical like the Zealots, calling for desperate measures to reform Christianity. You know, maybe we're all reformers in some way, which is what the Pharisees were, with their emphasis on the Bible. The first century spectrum of Judaism was hardly homogeneous. It was dynamic. It was varied. And the Essenes were one of many groups. And while as a younger Christian, I had quite a negative attitude towards those who would leave the centers of population for the peace of the desert, and I'm speaking of monks and nuns, desert fathers and desert mothers, I have a little bit of a different view now. And it's not that I think that it's fine not to engage in the world because we're sent out into the world, not to withdraw from it. But I do understand that some people withdraw not to escape God, but rather to hear his voice and to keep their faith intact. So I always wonder if it was me, let's say it's 100 BC, would I be tempted to join a group like that? I don't know. Maybe. Seven, deciphering the scroll notations. Now, I'll speak very quickly here because most of you are probably listening and not looking at the notes. But the way the scrolls are identified is important, and it does save time. And I've provided a picture. This is part of the temple scroll. And that's 11QT, and that's an uppercase K, an uppercase Q, an uppercase T, and then a superscript A. So it's 11QTA. 11 is the cave number. Remember, there are 11 caves. There are actually thousands, but 11 that we're concerned with. Q is Qumran. So all the Dead Sea Caves are connected with the Qumran community. T means the temple scroll. And then A, the superscript, means that's the first temple scroll, or the most significant, because there's more than one. There are actually several conventions for identifying the scrolls, and so even in my notes, you'll see different designations for the same work. Eight, materials. Well, the manuscripts were written on a variety of materials, not just papyrus or parchment, as you might imagine. About 100 are papyri, or 10% of the scrolls. 800 are on skins. About 90% of the scrolls are on vellum. That's like prepared animal skin. Again, parchment. Think of goats and calves, antelope were often used. And about 1% of the scrolls are written on metal, like tin or copper. And altogether, there are about 970 manuscripts. Let's just call it 1,000. Most of them were written outside of Qumran, though somewhere from inside. You know, without the arid climate of the Dead Sea region, and without being protected in secluded caves, Probably, the Dead Sea Scrolls would have rotted away long ago. And when I say arid, it is quite arid. There's only in that area about 5 or 7 centimeters of rain each year. And so if a big rain comes, it causes flash floods. On one of my recent trips to Israel, some people ignored the government's warning. They were closing the road and they ended up being swept away and drowning. In fact, even more died on the Jordanian side. That's the opposite side of the Dead Sea. Well, these amazing relics of the past, they've survived for nearly 2 millennia. And I'm very sympathetic with those who say this was the archaeological event of the 20th century. This is the most exciting, certainly for me as a Christian and someone who loves the Bible. That is exactly how I feel. Number 9, size. Well, how big are these scrolls? And you'll get the wrong idea. Again, if you're thinking each scroll, just think of how we normally think of a scroll. A piece of might look like paper wound up on a spool, and you just unwind it and it's perfect. Maybe you've been to a synagogue and you've seen how scrolls are today. This is unfortunately not the way most of these were found. Okay, some of the scrolls are tiny and others are amazingly large and in one piece. Amazing considering their antiquity. And sizes range from fragmentary all the way up to complete books of the Bible. Let me give you some representative fragments. And many are actually smaller than this. Here's one. It's 4Q447. We read, ... and to loathe, ... you instruct me, ... in order that, ... That's all the fragment contains. Another one I found, the only words they had are, have you now delayed? A third one, I'll just give you one more example. For then nations, ... and not your eye. Okay, and so what does that even mean? That's difficult. Some fragments actually contain only a single letter. But at the other extreme, some are over 7 meters long, like the best and most complete of the many Isaiah copies, 1Q Isaiah A, or even the Temple Scroll, that's over 8 meters long. So it's quite a range. Again, sorting through, translating, even just identifying each of these works is tedious. And yet now every fragment has been cataloged, photographed, published, even those that contain only a letter or two. And all have been available to anyone interested, once again, for 30 years plus. 10, language. The Dead Sea Scrolls are mainly in Hebrew. I guess that's not a big surprise, since these are Jewish documents and that's the holy language of the Jewish people. Though they actually reveal a different Hebrew text type than that from which the Greek Old Testament was translated, the Septuagint. And sometimes it's different to the Masoretic text. That's the text on which your English Bible is probably based. These are manuscripts from the Middle Ages. But Hebrew is number one, for sure. The next most common is Aramaic, which is a sister language of Hebrew, and in which about 1% of the Old Testament is written. There are also a number of Greek manuscripts in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Not many, but there are a few. And there are even a few in Nabataean, which is a form of Arabic. The Nabataean kingdom has the capital of Petra. Think if you've seen any of the Indiana Jones films, the last one, The Last Crusade, it's going on in this, looks like a temple, but this is in Petra. That's also probably where Saul of Tarsus spent some years, according to Galatians 1. 11, date range. Most of the scrolls date to well before the time of Christ. So the date range would be around 150 BC up until the first half of the first century AD. Now, this is significant because before the discovery of these scrolls, this is 1947, the oldest known surviving Hebrew manuscripts came from around 1000 AD. And there are some excellent manuscripts around that time, like the Aleppo Codex. Aleppo is a city in Syria, or the Codex Leningradensis from Leningrad, St. Petersburg, Russia. So what this meant is that translators and other scholars were now in a position to compare manuscripts to see Had it changed? Is there a difference between the Old Testament books surviving from before the time of Christ and the copies that they were working with 1,000 years later? Okay, that is significant, and we're going to return to that thought in a little bit too. But I'd like to shift now to talk about content. I mean, what are these works really about? What's included? Well, first, biblical manuscripts, about 225. Many come from the Law of Moses, that is the Torah, or Psalms, or Isaiah. The most commonly found Old Testament books in the scrolls are Deuteronomy, Psalms, and Isaiah. Interestingly, the same three Old Testament books most quoted in the New Testament, Deuteronomy, Psalms, and Isaiah. I know that because I've counted up all the quotations, and I was really reminded of that earlier this year when I recorded 31 talks from Isaiah. And as I looked to the New Testament, by far the majority of quotations from the prophets in our New Testament are from the book of Isaiah. So interestingly, the same three books that seem to have been so influential on early Christianity were also significant in this community. It makes you wonder what other connections there might be. Every book of the Old Testament is represented in the Dead Sea Scrolls, except for Esther. Although I did come across a scroll called Proto-Esther. So certainly the stories are familiar. And, you know, with all these scraps, kind of the leftovers that are not identifiable, there's always the possibility that those were from Esther or they could be from some other book. We just don't know. Not enough evidence to say. Oh, by the way, no New Testament documents are found on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Sometimes I hear people claiming they were. That's just false. The first New Testament documents would be Paul's early letters coming from, well, let's say if we give Galatians the year 48, and then Thessalonians 1 and 2 would be from the year 50. The letter of James could be from the 40s. That's possible. The Gospel of Mark would have been the earliest gospel, which is probably penned in the final years of the Qumran community. So we really shouldn't expect any New Testament documents to be in this Jewish community. That would be very surprising, especially since so much of the New Testament had not yet been written. In addition to biblical manuscripts, there are commentaries on biblical books, sometimes with intriguing facts and opinions. I'll give you a couple of examples. David, of course, the king had more than one wife. Well, his son Solomon had 700 and 300 concubines. But David had something like 15. He's exonerated for this because according to one of the manuscripts from K4, he hadn't read the Book of the Law because the Book of the Law was in the Ark of the Covenant and had been unopened since the death of Eleazar. That was Aaron's son who became the high priest. Okay. Sometimes we see geographical notes. The Sea of Reeds is what the Old Testament says the Israelites crossed, Yam Suf. The Red Sea is what the Greek translation says, or most English versions. But here we read about a branch of the Sea of Reeds that issues out of the Red Sea. And I know from a talk I attended on archaeology, some 20 years ago, that the Red Sea is a term that could refer to the Sea of Reeds. They weren't always as precise, as technical, as picky as you or I might be. And then there are also, by the way, scrolls that are older than the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been found, not at Qumran, but the oldest surviving are from the 6th century BC or even earlier. You'll have to look at the picture and the notes that I provided later on your own time. The scrolls also include some apocryphal works, that is, things that are not in the Bible, nor should they be. What did I learn? I read about the daughters of Adam, who had at least 10 children. Noah's wife, whose name is Amzara. We see that Abram and Sarai lived with Pharaoh for 2 years. This is a detail not supplied in Genesis. Pharaoh is attracted to the beautiful Sarah, who's about 65 years old here. And that's because of the lovely shape of her face, her wisdom, her fair skin, long, supple fingers, and so forth. And she would certainly have been considered beautiful by ancient canons of beauty, maybe even modern ones. We also read about the giants, the Nephilim, which you've seen in number 6 and other passages. The Nephilim, according to these scrolls, are 4,500 feet tall, 1,370 meters tall. Also in the Apocryphal works, David penned 4,050 psalms and other songs, and he spoke through the spirit of prophecy when he did so. You'll find documents like Psalm 154. You say, wait a minute, they're only 150. Exactly, these are Apocrypha. And then there are also rules for the community. No wearing dirty clothes on the Sabbath. Actually, there are lots of Sabbath rules. You can't take a bath on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Bigamy is fornication. The latrine has to be at least 1,000 cubits, that's 1,500 feet, outside the town, away from the congregation, which I think is because that was a latrine for defecation, not just urination. Sorry to be crass, but this is mentioned several times in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And also, it's a sin to slaughter an animal if it's carrying a live fetus. There are other disciplinary matters, and there are also some miscellaneous religious writings like the War Scroll, the New Jerusalem, the Book of Mysteries, or the famous Copper Scroll, 3Q15, which is a list of 64 buried treasures. And you can read this and you'll see, yes, there are lots of details on how to find them, but we don't really know the starting point. And I doubt that, well, who knows what could turn up in time. 13, the New Testament background. In 13 and 14, we're going to look at what I think is most useful for our faith. And in 15, we'll summarize the significance of the discovery overall. Well, as already noted, the Essenes responded negatively to the system. They viewed themselves as the true Israel, and they didn't hesitate to proclaim that unless you're holy like them, you're not going to make it. They were willing to head a new direction. And although their community and their theology didn't survive, right, we still can learn from them. They practice frequent baptisms, as I mentioned. Now, this is not Christian baptism. Christian baptism is a passive event. You don't baptize yourself, someone else does it. And you do it only once, and it's for forgiveness of sins. The immersions practiced at Qumran, as throughout Israel by strict Jews in immersion pools called mikvaot, one mikvah, two mikvaot, these were daily, and they were for self-administered, they're for ritual cleansing, right? So it's quite different. And that also means, though, that not only the Essenes, but most Jews in the time of Jesus, being accustomed to immersion, wouldn't have been taken aback seeing, say, thousands of believers being baptized into Christ around the Temple Mount in the Jerusalem area, because there were scores of baptismal pools, and this is something that the Jews did, but the purpose was very different. Okay, so the Jewish world was well familiar with immersion. We also, another thing that connects to the New Testament, the common meals. The community ate together and exchanging that kind of hospitality, just spending time together, it was something that built solidarity. I'm sure it strengthened the discipline of the community. And it's something that we see even in the book of Acts, like Acts 2 and Acts 4. And we're not talking about hundreds or thousands of people eating at the same time, but the importance of fellowship meals and what that does for community. Also discovered, dozens of phylacteries were found at Qumran. Those are small leather boxes containing passages of the Bible, normally like a scrap of Torah. Matthew 23:5 is a place where Jesus refers to the phylacteries. So this community had a very high regard for Scripture, and they devoted countless hours to studying and copying the Scriptures. Have you done that, by the way? Have you ever spent any time actually copying the Scriptures? I know it's easy just to open a Bible or to get into the digital format, but actually writing your own copy of verses or entire books of the Bible and try to do it without making any errors. I've done that. I mean, that's not easy, But these people really valued the scripture. They wrote about angels, demons, heaven and hell, the end times, the Messiah, and much more. And that shows that, in many ways, they shared the same theological world as the early Christians. Now, there were some important differences. The Essenes, like most Jews, were waiting for the age to come, the new age, you know, when the Messiah comes, and there will be an apocalyptic battle, a literal war. Whereas the Christians believed that the age to come had already dawned. It wasn't going to be military and political. The new age dawned in the person and ministry of Jesus Christ. Well, it's not surprising many people found that hard to understand when they were expecting that everything would change at one time. And the Christians are saying the Messiah has already come, the messianic age is here. Also significant for New Testament background, the Dead Sea Scrolls illuminate the common literary genre of apocalyptic. That's the kind of writing we see in later chapters of Daniel, or in Revelation, or in the apocryphal First Enoch. For example, in the New Jerusalem Scroll A, we find measurements and descriptions similar to those in Revelation 21. We also see the doctrine of a new creation after the last judgment, and that ties in well with 2 Peter 3:13 or Revelation 21:1. The Dead Sea Scrolls also help us to envisage the temple complex. For example, the courtyard of the women and foreigners. Only the high priest could go to the Holy of Holies, and only the priest could go into the holy place, the sanctuary, where they offered the sacrifices. But outside there was a court, of the Israelite, the men, but the women were a little more restricted, and foreigners could not cross a low barrier, and if they did, they could be executed. And we know that because there were many such notices that had been found. You can see some of those yourself if you visit Jerusalem or maybe Istanbul. So that helps me to, I always wondered, well, where does the Bible have women being separated? And okay, so 11Q19, column 15, lines 5 and 6, yes. Okay, that's where it is. It's not in the Bible. Another document holds that we're justified by works of the law. Though the Apostle Paul, formerly a Pharisee, that is himself an expert in the law, he opposes that view vigorously. The Essenes disagreed with the Pharisees, who permitted polygamy. The Essenes did not. Josephus, first century Jewish writer, tells us that the Essenes taught one another to hate evildoers and to help the just. Okay, well, that's interesting. I could only find one passage about not repaying aggression with evil. Maybe I missed something. I may have been going too quickly. But certainly, there are not many passages like that. And that helps us to appreciate how unusual Jesus' teaching on enemies is, like in Matthew 5, 38-48. There was a great parallel to Galatians 5, 16-21, where we read about two spirits being placed inside us, truth and deceit. So in Galatians, it's flesh and spirit. And to the spirit of deceit belong greed, sluggishness, and the service of justice, wickedness, falsehood, pride, haughtiness of heart, dishonesty, trickery, cruelty, much insincerity, impatience, much foolishness, impudent enthusiasm for appalling acts performed in lustful passion, filthy paths in the service of impurity, blasphemous tongue, blindness of eyes, hardness of hearing, stiffness of neck, hardness of heart, in order to walk in all the paths of darkness and evil cunning. Wow. What a passage in 1QS. That's the rule of the community. So, sin. We also see something of their doctrine of hell. And the visitation of all those who walk in it will be for an abundance of afflictions at the hands of all the angels of destruction, for eternal damnation by the scorching wrath of the God of revenges, for permanent terror and shame without end, with the humiliation of destruction by the fire of the dark regions. And all the ages of their generations they shall spend in bitter weeping and harsh evils in the abysses of darkness until their destruction, without there being a remnant or survivor for them. Wow, I mean, what a torrent of words. But interestingly, it speaks of eternal damnation and permanent terror and shame without end. But it also says, and maybe you heard that, until their destruction. So the word eternal doesn't mean nonstop torture for all time, the teaching of many churches today. Eternal normally has quite a different meaning, even in the Old Testament and the New Testament. In fact, in none of the extra-biblical Dead Sea Scrolls in my study could I find the later doctrine of infinite torment. And please correct me if you can find a counterexample. Just one more example from the New Testament. From the Dead Sea Scrolls that relates to the New Testament. Crucifixion until death for traitors and other criminals. That's mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls. See, before this time, before the Roman period, crucifying or hanging people up was only done after they had died. Being nailed on a cross was not a means of execution, but that's obviously changing. And we know that the Romans really perfected this, and they put down rebellions and slave revolts with mass crucifixion. I'm thinking of the slave revolt led by Spartacus, or I'm pretty sure it was the first century BC. A lot of Pharisees were giving them trouble, and I think they crucified 900 of them. Well, we've considered barely a dozen ways in which the Dead Sea Scrolls illuminate the New Testament. The best is yet to come. So let's talk about the Messiah, 14. Well, the Qumran community were definitely a messianic group, and their expectations, according to their own writings, at times converge with the Christian concept of the Messiah. Yet at other times, they diverge widely. Now, for them, the Christ, the Messiah, appears to be the Essene community leader, although he may be one of the Messiahs. Some scholars read the Dead Sea Scrolls as indicating two Messiahs. Let me just give you some of the highlights. A political military Messiah. Numbers 24:17 is applied to the coming royal Messiah. The scepter shall not depart from the tribe of Judah. While Israel has a dominion, there will not be cut off someone who sits on the throne of David. For the staff is the covenant of royalty, and the thousands of Israel are the standards until the Messiah of righteousness comes, the branch of David. For to him and his descendants has been given the covenant of kingship for his people for everlasting generations. So there's the royal Messiah. It's coming from a passage in Numbers uttered by Balaam, of all people. We also see that the Essenes anticipated an apocalyptic end times battle that they would participate in, and their military Messiah would lead them to victory. Now, in real contrast, Jesus said, you know, put away the sword. And the only sword we see Jesus bearing, so to speak, is in Revelation 19, where the sword comes out of his mouth, which seems to be the word of God. In Revelation, the so-called Battle of Armageddon features no actual warfare. And besides, Christ's people don't kill their enemies. And then, according to the Qumran interpretation of Isaiah, the enemies are to be destroyed. And that explains the negative reception of Jesus at Nazareth in Luke 4, when he highlights Gentiles, whom the Jews considered outsiders and enemies. He highlights them for praise or for attention. And that simply doesn't fit with their concept of what the Messiah does. Although the Nazarene's concept is close to what was understood at Qumran. And oddly enough, Psalm 110 was not interpreted as applying to the Messiah, but only to Melchizedek. And that's interesting because Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my feet until I make your enemies a footstool. You know that passage. That's the most quoted Old Testament passage in the New Testament. But in the Greek manuscripts at Qumran, it's not understood as referring to the Messiah. I'll skip this part, but in the notes you'll see the section about the two messiahs. And Jesus did not lead his followers into the desert, awaiting the end times battle between the sons of light and sons of darkness. Rather, he equipped us to go out into the world, teaching and leavening and discipling all nations, but not killing them. Another contrast. Oh, this may be interesting to some of you. The physical appearance of the Messiah. This is what they're expecting in one of the manuscripts. And again, the Messiah's eyes are between pale and dark. His nose long and handsome, his teeth well aligned. His hair abundant, his beard thin but not too scraggly. His limbs smooth and with sufficient fat. Interesting, huh? I mean, in the New Testament, there's not a single piece of description of Jesus, what he looked like. But here, Messiah, his teeth are well aligned, as though he benefited from orthodontry. He's got the perfect nose and limbs and so forth. There's a manuscript that's incomplete that just refers to his nails and his height and his feet, but that's all. It doesn't give us any units or, well. So, in contrast, the New Testament doesn't show any interest in the physical appearance of Christ, which means probably he looked like the average Jewish male of his day. Well, also, in some manuscripts, the Messiah is referred to as Son of God and Son of the Most High. Some of the skeptics I've talked to, or even debated, think that the church turned Jesus from a wise or holy man into some kind of a god. But that's not necessary. Not only was the phrase Son of God around in Jesus' day, although usually referred to the Emperor of Rome, it was understood in certain Jewish circles as referring to the Messiah. These terms weren't invented by Christ followers. And this high Christology, this view of Christ as being not just human but divine, is present at every level, every layer of the New Testament, from the oldest to the newest documents. The best preserved of the 20 or so Isaiah manuscripts, and now I'm jumping outside my the frame here because this talk is on the non-biblical scrolls, but I can't resist mentioning the biblical scrolls. But the crown jewel, if you go to the Israel Museum, is the long Isaiah manuscript A. There are two that are complete. Well, B is almost complete. Isaiah A, B, and then there are many more. But if you ever go to the Israel Museum, you'll go inside the Shrine of the Book. It's a subterranean, air-conditioned museum, and the prize display is of the over 7 meter long Isaiah scroll. And as you could well imagine, when this was first discovered, scholars, particularly of Christian faith, quickly jumped on, well, they wanted to find out what about the very specific prophecies of the Messiah. What do we read in, for example, Isaiah 7 or 11 or 42 or 61 or 53? All right, Isaiah 52, 13, 50 through 12, the most famous. This is the passage that the Ethiopian eunuch was reading when Philip evangelized him in Acts chapter 8. And yes, it's the same as the later manuscripts of the Middle Ages. Well, there was one difference of three letters, but it didn't change anything. That is, Isaiah 53 is still Isaiah 53. We also read that when the Messiah comes, heaven and earth obey him. The dead are raised, the sick are healed, the oppressed are rescued. Fascinating. That's all in the scrolls before the time of Christ. Okay, time to land the plane. But I need to do that by recapitulating just a little bit here. What is it that the Dead Sea Scrolls teach us? 15. What are the key points that inform and bolster our Christian faith and which we can share with our friends? So I've got a few thoughts on Scripture and then a few thoughts on Christ. First, we're reminded that the ancient Jews were very serious about careful copying of Scripture. That should give us confidence in the accuracy of the Old Testament. Next, since 1947, the oldest surviving or extant manuscripts of the Old Testament date from the centuries before the time of Christ. Remember, the community was abandoned in the first century AD when the Roman legions were closing in. And that led to the preservation of the scrolls for some 19 centuries, right up to the time of their discovery. The Romans indirectly did us all a huge favor because the pressure they put on Qumran, so Qumran abandons the scrolls. So instead of having to rely only on medieval scrolls, scholars have access to works that are 1,000 years older. Wow. Yes, there are minor differences between the biblical Dead Sea Scrolls and medieval manuscripts, say from 1000 AD, but they don't undermine doctrine or otherwise obscure the biblical message. The message is robust, it shines through, and it's intelligible to those willing to receive it. And last, sometimes the scrolls clarify difficult passages in the Hebrew. And when that does occur, modern Bibles usually offer a footnote. So the Dead Sea Scrolls frequently serve to enhance our knowledge of the Old Testament. Non-biblical Dead Sea Scrolls illuminate the kind of Messiah that was expected in the time of Christ. And several of Jesus' attributes are found explicitly in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that means that the early Christians didn't need to concoct a notion of a miraculous divine Messiah. Such a notion of the Messiah was already present. And furthermore, in the biblical Dead Sea Scrolls, the prophetic material pointing to Jesus Christ, it's all there. And that's from before his lifetime. And that means it wasn't added in, it wasn't fudged by the early church. The first time I showed Isaiah 53 to a Jewish friend of mine and asked him what he thought, he said, well, obviously that was written after Jesus lived and died. It was made up by the church. And I remember the look on his face when I said, no, my friend, that's from before the time of Christ. He was amazed. I was amazed too. Oh, there's so much more I would love to share with you. Check out the notes and you'll find more. For example, what the Essene said, what you do if your animal falls into a ditch, it may not be what you think. But take a look at those notes, share the talk with your friends, and thank you for taking out this time from your day to learn about this most exciting archaeological discovery of a century.